little beauty was La Girona from Phil's album The Gate. And now it is time for the Jazz Podcast.
Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Good morning, Dan.
How's it going?
It's good. How are you doing?
Very good.
So, welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today is it episode 20 or 21?
I've no idea, Rob.
All right, let's look. Crumbs. What a start. What a shambolic start.
Not for the best of starts. No, it must be 20.
Yeah, we're 21? Spreading. It's 20.
20, cool.
Big time episode 20 with Phil Donkin. Phil's been everywhere because he studied in London. I won't ruin the story, actually, but be prepared for some transatlantic travel. Just ruin the story. Episode 20, and this is the summer of the Jazz Podcast. So we're going to do an episode every week until September, basically because I've got nothing else to do. And then we'll take a break in September and go and grab some more interviews and talk to people, and then start up again maybe in February like we did last year.
Nice.
Seems quite neat. Few months off, and then season two will start exactly the same time that season one started.
Hopefully people will get desperate.
Big desperation. Yeah, maybe the odd show in between, some like London Jazz Festival shows in November.
Oh, yeah, we got the festival.
Yeah. Oh, and if you Google the Jazz Podcast, we're third now in the... You know, Google, you can't sort of force it to put you at the top. If you just type in like good jazz podcasts or are there any jazz podcasts, anything like that. We didn't used to come up because we were too small time. Give it a try. See what happens.
Nowhere to be seen.
Oh, boy. Well, I've heard rumours, but I'll get back to work. See if we can improve.
We are the second page.
Okay. We got to
climb. I think if it remembers what searches you've done, yeah, which you've clicked on.
Okay, because that wasn't me. So a listener got in touch and told me that that when they were searching, we were coming up as third on page one. So I'm going to go back to said listener and give him a damn good talking to. Yeah, our one loyal listener, Jack Davies, working the Google machine. So should we play Phil's show?
Let's do it.
Sweet. So, Phil Donkin, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
You're living in Berlin now.
Berlin, yeah.
Cool. When did you move to Berlin?
It's 4 years ago.
And you moved from New York?
Yeah.
Cool. Right. Nice. So, whereabouts in Berlin? Just out of interest.
It's Kreuzberg. Kreuzberg. Do you know the geography of Berlin at all?
I don't, but I am massively cheating on Google Maps. I'm zooming in on Berlin. Okay, tell me about it.
Well, it's sort of quite central.
Oh, cool.
Sort of pretty trendy.
Yes, if you zoom in on Berlin on Google Maps, it's directly beneath the word Berlin.
Yeah, it's like ridden with hipsters.
Like the London equivalent of Shoreditch.
I sort of... There's a lot of them on my street, but I just tolerate them, you know.
Sounds cool, man. Sounds like a vibey neighborhood.
No, yeah, it is cool. Yeah, it's a nice place to live.
Oh, sweet. So let's go back in time and talk about when you first started. Or where did you grow up?
Grew up in Sunderland, northeast England.
Oh, nice.
Where I was born. And I lived there till I was 17. I moved to London when I was 17. So that's just a big 17-year skip.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. When I did Tom Corley's show, I asked him a few questions about his childhood and growing up, and halfway through he just stopped and went, "Rob, nobody wants to know about this. Can we just move on, please?"
I'm happy to talk about that.
No, that'd be great. I'd love to know about when you started playing the bass and what drew you to it in the first place.
Yeah, well, I'm the youngest of five kids. And
wow.
Cool. Yeah, so I've got two older brothers and two older sisters, and it spans quite a long time of, you know, age. The oldest brother's 14 years older, and then it's like incrementally down.
Yeah.
You'll meet, and then basically they were all really into music, and my two oldest brothers, they're the oldest two, the two boys. They both play guitar, and then one of my sisters also played guitar and sings stuff. So I think I just always heard music from day one, basically.
Yeah.
My mom played piano as well. And yeah, just music was always around. And also it was a lot of different types of music. Because my brothers, being the age they were, I was born in 1980, but my oldest brother was born in like 66.
Right.
So, you know, my earliest memories, sort of early 80s, sort of like there was a lot of new romantic stuff, new wave punk stuff.
Yeah.
Hearing that. The Smiths and even the Sex Pistols and all that kind of stuff. And, my sister was really into like Dirty Dancing and all that kind of stuff, mid-80s.
Cool.
So it was just this weird mixture of all these musics. And I didn't have any idea about genre or anything like that. It was just all just music. I didn't know what era they were from or anything like that. So yeah, just it was all this music was going on the whole time. and then my brothers both, as I said, played guitar, and then there was always guitars in the house. So I was just always messing around on it. I couldn't really ever do very much on it, but I think at some point, yeah, I just figured out a few chords and that, you know.
Yeah.
One album that was like, my sister listened a lot to this album by Tracy Chapman. It's quite a famous record from the 80s. It had like Fast Car and all that, those tunes on it. And because my sister liked singing it and playing it, we had a book with all the, you know, the lyrics and the sheet music. I couldn't read any of it, obviously, but they had like guitar chord shapes in there.
Oh, cool. And, yeah.
And they were really easy chords, like E minor and A and G. And like, if you play guitar, you'll know that they're the really easy chords to learn.
Yeah.
And because I heard that album so much, like I knew the songs. So I could get this book and figure out what those chords were. And I would just like teach myself those tunes and sing along and all that. And I think I must have been, I don't know, about 10 at that point.
Yeah.
And kind of just, I don't know if I realized anything, but I just really enjoyed that, you know, and just kept messing around, really.
Wow, cool.
And then the bass, I think the bass appealed to me because it was the one instrument that nobody in my family played, so that they couldn't tell me like what to do, couldn't say, oh, that's wrong, you know.
Yeah.
And I was also like fascinated because I'd watch Top of the Pops every week, and there'd always be these bands on, and it'd be like a singer, a drummer, guitar player, sometimes keyboard. And I never really looked closely enough to see, like, sometimes there were two guitar players and one of them was actually a bass.
Yeah. I remember really that know. When I was a kid, yeah. Being like, what the f*** is going on there?
Yeah. Yeah. And I couldn't, the fascinating thing about it was I couldn't hear it. Do you know what I mean?
Because
it was coming through TV speakers.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I can hear the guitar. I can hear the drums. I can hear the singer. I know what they're for. But that guy playing that big guitar with four strings, I don't know what he's for. You know what I mean? Because a lot of like rock music and stuff, the bass is actually just doubling the guitar part down an octave. So unless you've got quite a trained ear, it's quite hard to like discern that, you know.
Yeah.
And but I was fascinated by it because I couldn't understand like why it was there, and that made me just curious, you know. And I think the turning point was, I think I was 12. I saw the Blues Brothers film, and that's like soul music and stuff. And not only could I see the bass really close up, could see the strings moving and the fingers moving and stuff, but I could really hear what the bass player was doing. It's Donald Duck Dunn, who's like a legend, who's the bass player in that film.
Right.
But yeah, I could. So, and the thing about soul and funk music is that the bass is often doing something kind of different to the guitar. You know, it's kind of often playing quite a sort of counter melody to the vocal. So it really stands out. So at that point, I really kind of got what the bass was doing, you know.
Yeah.
Why the bass player was there.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I mean, that was the point where I wanted to play the bass. You know, I was like, that's what I want to do. Just really appealed to me. So by this point, both my brothers had left home, but my sister was still at home. I don't think she played her guitar very much. And it was just sitting there, and I think the top two strings were broke, so it was just the bottom four strings, same as the bass.
Yeah.
So I would just like, we had Blues Brothers on video. I think I taped it. I recorded it from the TV, you know.
Yeah.
And I would just like press play and find the first note, and then find that on this guitar, and then continue, find the second note, keep doing like that. Now I just learn all the tunes that way. Took a very long time, but I thought of, at some point I could play most of the record. Just sort of taught myself how to do it, you know.
Wow, this is such a committed start. What a way to go when you're like 12 and you're transcribing and pausing and one note at a time. That is a very hard and slow.
Well, it just seemed like the only way it was going to happen.
Yeah,
I just sort of had this determination then that just I wanted to just do it, you know.
I remember doing that with Michael Brecker solos when I was at college, like runs that were like light speed, and I would like slow it down to like 10%, and then and then do one semiquaver at a time and spend weeks on something that amounted to about like 3 seconds of music.
Yeah. But it's very satisfying once, even when you get a couple of notes down, you're like, oh wow, I've just figured that out.
Yeah.
So I think when I got the first tune I probably learned was the Peter Gunn theme from the Blues Brothers. Which
yeah, I know the one.
Do 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 do. It's just that the whole way through.
Yeah.
And very easy. But I think the fact I learned how to do that, I think it gave me a bit of confidence to keep going with the other ones. So yeah, I think I was inspired by the fact that that had been sort of achievable somehow, you know.
Yeah.
So then I started doing that with other records, you know, and other music I was listening to, cassettes, and I think I still only had cassettes at that point, early 90s.
Yeah.
And I was listening to, like, REM and Queen and Guns N' Roses and bands like that. And I would just try and figure stuff out by ear. And it got to the point where I was just, like, annoying my parents, like, can you buy me a bass? I really want to play bass. But they obviously didn't want to spend money on a bass for me to then kind of just ditch it.
Is it an upright you were wanting?
No, electric.
Electric, right.
Yeah. I didn't start playing upright till I was about 20.
Oh, right, cool.
Yeah. So luckily we had some friends. My parents had some friends whose children were musicians, like my age, and they loaned me a bass. They had a bass. So I borrowed that for a few months and started taking some lessons from a guy. My mom was a teacher in a secondary school, and she got the music teacher there recommended a bass player who could teach me. So I started going to him for every week. Every Sunday I went to him for 2 years, every morning.
Wow, 2 years. Nice.
So his name, ironically, was Paul Chambers.
Great.
No relation.
Just a coincidence, eh? But a good sign, a very good start.
Yeah, totally. And that was a really great time, you know, from the age of like 12 to 13, 14, just lived and breathed bass. That's all I wanted to do. Didn't do any homework.
Yeah.
I just got in from school every day and just played bass all night. Just played along with records, basically. Just, like, would learn records by ear. Play them from beginning to end, and then I'd get bored and move on. Like, every time I learn a record, I'd find a new record, a new task kind of thing.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was how it was, basically. And that teacher was great because he showed me a load of stuff that, as I said, like my my family was musical, but there's certain things they wouldn't have known about, like sort of beginning into jazz in a way, like Stanley Clark and Larry Graham, bass players like that. And, you know, so that was really, you know, an eye-opener as well.
Yeah. So at what point did you realize that, like, jazz was going to be the thing that you wanted to be doing with your bass?
Well, it was, like I said, like I would learn a record and then get bored of that and then move on to another record. And then, but what tended to be happening was the records I wanted to learn were progressively more with like really flashy bass players. And I was trying to like learn what they were doing. So, I was really into bands like Primus and Chili Peppers and just anything where the bass was really technical and loud. That's what I was into. But there was a sort of limitation in that once I sort of learned all the riffs and stuff, that was sort of it, you know. And I don't know who it was, but, well, actually, I had a music teacher at school as well, my secondary school, who was a sax player, jazz player. Mm-hmm. And he sort of, I think, figured out by this point I had a bit of a aptitude for music. So, and I was always asking questions like, who are the great bass players I haven't heard of? Who can you recommend? So he basically gave me a few tapes actually. And it was mostly jazz. Well, it was actually like fusion because electric bass. So it was sort of like Chick Corea, Electric Band and Yellow Jackets and Dave Sanborn with Marcus Miller on bass and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it was like, that was really impressive stuff. Although, because I found the music a bit corny, to be honest, but I was impressed by the bass playing.
Yeah.
But he also gave me a tape of like Mingus, and I really loved that. And I hadn't really heard any double bass players yet at that point.
Right.
But Mingus, I loved Mingus's play. And he also gave me another tape of Oney Jacko stuff. And probably not the only bass player that when they first hear Jacko, I mean, that's like a day zero moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like everything else that you were checking out.
I love that. Day zero, you start a diary like, today is the first day.
Yeah, it's pretty much like that.
Yeah.
Because everything else I sort of had been checking out sort of paled into insignificance at that point.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe like how, like just the technical brilliance of it. But the thing that really amazed me was the fact that it was a lot of it was improvised. And it was like, how are you getting that information through? Sorry, my girlfriend just sneezed.
I thought that didn't sound close enough to be you.
So I just thought, like, how are you getting that information? First of all, how is that information in your head anyway? And how is it coming out through your hands, through the bass?
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe how sophisticated it was, you know?
Yeah.
Like Donnelly and stuff, like, it's just like, how on earth? So it was just the fact that he could improvise that stuff. And it made me realize and understand that to be able to do that, you have to have such a, like a profound understanding of theory and rhythm and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just copy a record and, you know, it takes a lot more. So it sort of became a task then at that point to try and learn about jazz and jazz theory because I couldn't just copy Jacko's records like I had with other things. It just took far too much skill, you know.
Yeah.
Just like orally, you know. So that was, it was a day zero moment. Because at that point, I sort of wasn't really interested in reading music or theory. Because even though my teacher had been trying to, like, tell me how important theory and stuff was and reading, I just wasn't interested. I just wanted to turn up and shred, basically.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, there was no way around it. I was never going to be able to play like Jacko unless I could, you know, new theory. So, but in Sunderland, it was pretty difficult because there just isn't a community for that at all. At least there wasn't then.
Yeah.
And, well, maybe there was, I just didn't know anybody because I was just a teenager. And, so it was that music teacher who gave me those tapes was pretty much the only guy I knew who could tell me anything about jazz harmony and stuff. So he would explain how chords worked and stuff like that. even then, it was, my understanding was pretty limited. It was because I didn't have any practical experience or application.
Yeah.
So I spent a couple of years sort of working on that. I had a book called Improvising Jazz Bass by Rick Laird.
Mm-hmm.
That had a lot of stuff in there. Again, just explained how chords worked and bass lines, and had a few chord sequences from standards to, you know,
yeah,
give you examples of how to approach walking bass lines and all that. But it was still quite a departure. It was quite a big step for me to sort of hear that stuff being applied and recognizing it. Because at the same time as all this, I was listening to as much jazz as I could. Because I would go to Sunderland Library because they had a minute jazz section about a meter wide. And
that's a great way to measure it, rather than like by the number of albums.
Yeah.
A meter of jazz.
That was it. And a lot of it was really terrible stuff, but I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know who was good. I didn't know who was bad.
Yeah.
So, but I read Miles Davis's autobiography, the Quincy Troupe one.
Oh, cool.
Basically, nice. All the things he said he liked, I made a note and I just would see if they had it at the library. And
yeah.
Okay, John Coltrane, you know.
Yeah.
Things like that, Charlie Parker. So I would check that stuff out. But I would hear it and not really see the connection between what I was hearing and what I was seeing in the books I was reading about. Because it's very advanced, you know.
Yeah, it's quite an inaccessible.
Yeah, and the stuff I was reading about was very basic also. It's the most basic way of approaching that. And
right.
So it's so many layers of nuance and stuff when you're hearing actually it being done properly.
Yeah.
It was frustrating just not understanding, but I guess I was just determined or stubborn or something. I just kept going. And also we're very ignorant, which helps because you can just not know how crap you are and just keep going.
I think there's a lot to be said for that when you're starting to learn jazz, because there's so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, but thank God, because if you knew how big of a thing it was, you'd probably give up.
Yeah. And so when you, Guildhall, how did this come about then? How does it fit in your kind of going to a music college and studying formally?
I'll go back a little bit. When I was 17, I moved to London. I started doing my A-levels in Sunderland. I did A-level music and also A-level music theory, like two different A-levels.
Oh, cool. I didn't know there was.
Well, there wasn't for long because the school like scrapped it after a couple of weeks.
Right.
So they scrapped both those A-level courses.
Oh, crap, and you were on them?
And I was on them.
Oh, God, that's a nightmare.
It was like, the only alternative was like, there was a BTEC in popular music.
Yeah.
Which was the equivalent of two A-levels in terms of a qualification.
Yeah.
And I did that for about a month, but I couldn't hack it because it was like, it was just really boring. It was like, I was a bit too advanced for that point. I mean, I wasn't like advanced, you know, at all really, but literally the people who were on that course would just started playing guitar, you know, or whatever. And it was just a bit limiting and I got very frustrated and I don't know, at that age, I was just a bit...
That's not a good age to feel like you're being held back.
No, I just sort of stopped concentrating and stopped working on anything and I've lost my way a little bit. And at that point, you know, just started kind of going out clubbing and stuff with my friends. And
yeah.
That became the focus and just wasn't a very focused existence. And so I got to the point where I'd actually dropped out of that BTEC course and I wasn't doing anything anymore.
Yeah.
So I was just sort of unemployed and not studying anywhere.
Yeah.
So, and me and my parents sort of looked into some other places to study A-level music because obviously there's several courses, you know, there's many options.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of schools. But none of them really looked appealing. There probably were places I could have gone, but my oldest brother, the one who's a lot older than me, he lived in London at that time. And I had my heart set on going to London because I just really wanted to get out and go and play and go and hear music. Because I'd been checking out a lot of jazz for those 2 years between 15 and 17, and that's all I wanted to do. And So my parents just somehow just gave up and said I could go and live with my brother in London.
Oh, amazing.
So I went down there and lived in Broccoli in Lewisham.
Yeah.
Started doing an A-level music course down in Lewisham. Started late, but basically did it in a year and a half.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Just did A-level music and art. Just did two subjects. Because at this point, I already decided I wanted to go to Guildhall.
Yeah. And you just need two A-levels to get
in. Exactly. So I only took two A-levels so I could do the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that and got, you know, passed, got two average passes at A-level, but it was good enough. But I auditioned for the Guildhall in the sort of winter of 98. So I'd only been in London about 6 months, and I still knew, like, nothing about jazz, really.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things. So I was amazed that I got in, because the course was on double bass, and I didn't even play double bass. So it's a bit weird.
Yeah, of course. That's a real unusual situation for like the bassists suffer.
Yeah. Well, there was the guy before me let me use his, like, they told me, do you have a double bass? And I was like, no, don't play double bass. So like, this is a double bass audition. I'm like, right. So I borrowed the guy before me, borrowed his bass.
Yeah.
And, I couldn't play it, and I just walked in there and I was like, I can't play this instrument, but I can play electric. And they were like, well, okay, we'll ask you a few questions. So they asked me to play like a blues or something, and I've tried, you know, hacked my way through a blues really terribly. And I played Satin Doll, I think, on the electric, and just like, I had no idea what was going on. I can't believe that I got in, really.
Yeah.
But Simon Purcell was one of the people in the auditions, and I think he just asked me a question like, what are you listening to at the moment? You know, and for some reason that week I'd just bought the Portrait in Jazz record, the Bill Evans record.
Yeah.
And I think part of me probably knew who, because he was a piano player, and I knew that. I just thought I'd say that because I thought that might impress him. And I think when I said Portrait in Jazz, Bill Evans, I saw something change in his eyes, and I think he liked me. So, but at that point I thought, well, I've totally blown this.
Yeah.
I'm not getting in. Anyway, I got a letter a few weeks later to say that I'd go in.
Wow.
That's over the moon, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I also auditioned at the Academy, and I didn't get in there.
Right.
And they were really rude to me. It's horrible. But, you know, that was sort of the confidence blower. That was a real kicker for the confidence. But I think the Guildhall audition was the same week. So, and that was after.
Oh, that's hard. That's the thing that I don't think colleges ever really appreciate. Or maybe they do now. It's gotten better. But sometimes, like, how much it means to the people that are auditioning and how much you can affect them and their confidence with your attitude and how you treat them.
Yeah, it's a funny one.
When I auditioned, it was so bizarre. You did just two choruses of the A Train.
Did you go to the Academy?
Yeah, I did. I did the postgrad. And you played the head. You did two choruses, and then they stopped you before the head out. And that was it, and you left. And then after, like, the whole morning of hearing everyone do that, they just blue tack a handwritten note to the wall of the people they wanted to hear again.
Wow.
So they were making judgments off about 40 seconds of improvising, you know, whether they thought you were worth 2 years of their time. Mm. Happily, it wasn't going on by the time I left anymore, but, you know, quite often. Yeah. And one guy came in really angry once, I remember, and he sort of said to the panel, you know, last year I felt really disrespected, I was really unhappy, and they're really apologetic and everything, but it's kind of, yeah, it's weird.
I mean, that was probably more recently, right? I mean, when was that?
Yeah, that was 2010.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, when I auditioned, it was 98, so it was like, that was even before Gerard was teaching there. It was like the old Graham Collier.
Right.
It was like that. And, yeah, I think, well, you know, like Nick Smart's great.
Nick really put an end to all that about the interview, like the audition process being sort of too rushed for its own good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
So anyway, sorry about the convoluted nature of the story.
No, it all makes, you know, the character of the player you are. That's the whole joy of this show, that every single person we have on has a... I love this about jazz. There's no one way that anyone does anything. So everyone's story is completely different.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. I thought with like younger players that there'd be less variation, but that's just totally not the case at all.
Right.
You know, because like with the really old school guys like Stan Saltzman, he sort of just, you know, he's like, you just started playing. And because there wasn't jazz courses, so there was.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you enjoy Guildhall?
Yeah, I did.
Was it like a full jazz course or a...
Yeah.
Right, cool.
It was a 4-year thing. Mm-hmm. First 2 years I had to do classical.
Right, that I wondered about that.
So I basically had to start playing the double bass.
Yeah.
It was just non-negotiable. And I really didn't want to. I didn't want to play double bass at all.
Yeah.
But I mean, that my first year I sort of didn't really... I did the bare minimum, you know, and I certainly didn't play double bass in any sort of jazz groups.
Yeah.
I just did my classical lessons and that, you know.
Got the hell out of there.
Well, basically what somebody said to me, a few friends said to me, like, look, because I wasn't playing as much as I would have liked to. And they were like, well, look, if you, no one really wants to play jazz with electric bass. So I was like, oh. So they said, if you start playing the upright, you know, you'd probably be playing more. And that was the thing I really needed more than anything at that point, was to play, because I had very little playing experience, you know. And I was a complete beginner, really, when I started the course. And everyone else there on the same course had some kind of, they'd sort of been playing in some sort of local big band, youth big band or something. And I didn't get to do that, so... I did feel a bit like, you know, like catching up.
Yeah.
I had to catch up. So basically at the end of my first year, I sort of, you know, sucked it up and just started bringing my upright bass to jams and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I didn't really have a bass either. I bought the school where my mom taught at, there was a bass, double bass that nobody used. So that the teacher let me borrow it, basically. And that was cool. The bass. That was the bass I had, but it was a terrible instrument.
Right.
So I just used to schlep that around, basically. I wasn't aware of wheels or anything, so I just had to, like, carry it around on the tube all the time.
Really annoying. That sounds brutal.
Yeah, it was. So that was it, really. And I think I just started. I think once I made the decision to commit to the double bass, I mean, I really did do that and just started really listening to what other musicians. That was one of the great things about Guildhall. I mean, like the teachers would give very good advice, and also some of the older students and stuff. They were like, "Check this out, listen to this," and I just tried to do as much research as I could. So I would listen to like Dave Holland and Paul Chambers and just really try to get a feel for what the bass should be doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it was hard, you know, because I think at that point on, I was quite good on the electric. I could sort of shred on it. I mean, I wasn't a very good bass player in the sense of like holding down a groove or being a supportive band member, but technically I could shred on the electric bass, and I just hated the fact that I wasn't going to be able to do that on the upright. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
But actually, playing the upright was a good lesson for that, because it was just like, right, I can't do any of that stuff. So
yeah,
I actually have to focus on being a good, proper bass player.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was good. Sort of forced into it. It was actually good that I didn't get into the academy, because they wouldn't have made me play upright, because that wasn't compulsory.
Right. It's funny how these things always figure themselves out.
Yeah.
It's like golf. You make your own luck.
Right. Yeah.
Tenuous.
Yeah.
So after Guildhall, you, how many years did you stay in London for?
Five, another 5 years.
Cool. And then what were you up to in those five?
Really just playing. I mean, by the time I got to about third year of Guildhall, I'd, by this point I'd passed my driving test, and I, as soon as I had a car, my parents gave me their battered old Renault 19.
Yeah.
As soon as I had a car, I just started getting loads of gigs.
Sweet.
So I was started actually, before long, I'd paid off my overdraft, and I was actually paying, able to support myself.
Yeah.
From gigs.
Yeah.
Well, I think I was still in fourth year or so. So by the time I actually left Guildhall, it was just a very smooth transition to working.
Great.
So,
that's perfect.
Well, I'd just be doing any gig I was asked to do, you know, whatever it was, restaurant, pub gig, or club, you know. If I was free, I would do it.
Yeah.
And that's basically what I did for those 5 years. I mean, the gigs, over the years, the gigs got a little bit more prestigious, I guess. I was not doing quite as much sort of restaurant and bar gigs, but...
I remember seeing you when I was at the Royal Northern playing with Gwilym Simcock. I think you played in the college concert hall.
Right, yeah, yeah. Oh, that would have been about 2007, I think.
Yeah, that would have been my second year of college.
Right.
I remember, I can't remember why, we got a taxi together. You and I, God knows why, or if we were going.
Me and you.
Yeah, honestly. We got a taxi. There must have been someone else in it because it wouldn't make sense to it just be the two of us. But I remember going past Manchester Town Hall in it. But that's it. There must have been food involved. I can't think for the life of me why.
Oh, that was you.
That was.
I was wondering if we'd actually met. Mm. So there you go.
Yeah, we
have. I remember going to a Chinese restaurant.
Oh my God, a Chinese, you're filling in the blanks.
Yeah.
Phil, I never thought I'd get the rest of that memory back.
There was Gwilym, and there was Christine, Alan was there.
Yeah.
Martin, France, the drummer.
Oh my God, I can't believe this. This is so weird. That's like a different life to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've got a pretty good memory for stuff.
That is obscene. I'm so impressed. Do you remember what you ate?
No.
Maybe it wasn't that good a restaurant.
It was a fairly typical, you know, Chinese restaurant, yeah. I think.
So I'd love to know what it was then that sort of inspired you to try and move to New York, and how easy it was to move, because you hadn't moved to study.
Hmm. Well, it's quite a convoluted story, really. It all sort of, there's a few circumstances that led to that. You know, it wasn't just a, you know, clear decision.
Right.
I'd been in a relationship with a girl for a long time, opera singer who I'd met at Guildhall, and we'd lived together in London for a long time during that whole period. And then at some point, she moved to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
She moved to Heidelberg, and I was sort of, we were like long distance for a while. And then she moved after a year of that, she moved to Leipzig. And at this point I was sort of getting a bit fed up with sort of my lifestyle in London.
Yeah.
I was basically, I was playing all the time, you know, I was playing 4 or 5 nights a week and doing a lot of rehearsals. I mean, just, I didn't have a moment to myself, really.
Yeah.
And I was almost always exhausted. And I basically lived in my car. And I was just constantly in my car, stuck in traffic, getting from place to place.
Yeah.
And I just was a bit fed up of not having any energy.
Yeah.
And, of course, because London's so expensive, you sort of have to do every work opportunity that comes along. It's sort of hard.
Tell me about it.
It's hard to stop. Hard to justify turning work down.
Yeah.
In London. And I think at some point, I don't know when exactly, but like I said, those initial years out of Guildhall, getting that experience, just doing any gig, that was like invaluable experience. It was amazing. Yeah. I'm really glad I got that chance to do that, you know, just playing in little bars and restaurants where some singer, you know, is calling My Funny Valentine, A flat minor, no chart. Just get it together now. You know?
Even now, if you don't please.
Know, yeah, even if you don't know it.
Yeah.
I remember having to do that a lot. And those skills are really, those practical skills are really great. And but the reason why I'm talking about that is that that's great that I got to do that. But forever is a bit like, all right, well, you know, there's only, you can learn a lot from that, but there's a point where you're like, all right, well, I want to do something a bit more creative. Yeah. Not to say that all the gigs I was doing were like that, because of course they weren't. Gwilym, for example, I thought it was a very fulfilling, you know, musical experience playing with him. And but not everything I was doing was like that. And also the stuff I was doing that was really good, because I was so tired from everything else, I felt I couldn't really give 100%.
Yeah,
everything I was doing, my hands were often sore from playing so much, and I just felt like I wasn't improving anymore.
Right.
I felt like I wasn't getting any better. I felt like actually I might be getting worse, because I wasn't, not, no one was really challenging me in the sense of like, you know, you sound good, but your time at this tempo sucks. You need to go and work on it. Nobody was saying those kind of things.
Yeah.
And I feel like I really needed that, you know what I mean? It felt a bit too easy to just leave college and then just be super busy and doing really good gigs. On the one hand, it was nice, but on the other hand, it was like somehow this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
So anyway, the reason how I connect that to this girlfriend who was in Leipzig. Well, when she moved to Leipzig, I was really looking for a change. I didn't know how or when or why. But Leipzig's close to Berlin. It's like an hour away on the train.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I always wanted to move. I always wanted to leave England and just check out somewhere else.
Yeah.
Just to see another way of life, you know, and experience a different culture. Berlin was in one of my top lists of places to go. It was like Paris or Barcelona or, you know, like Amsterdam, Copenhagen or Berlin.
Yeah.
And because she was near Berlin, I thought, well, that kind of kills two birds with one stone. I could be closer to her and not have this long distance thing where I only see her like once a month. Because that was also a pain, you know, and adding complications. So I could be closer to her and then sort of just experience something new. I was really just desperate for a change.
Yeah.
So I just, in 2008, I just decided to do it, you know, just went over there and got a place. It was quite easy to do it. During the first year I was in Berlin, I kept a room in London and I kept my car there and had another base I kept there. So I would go back every other week, mm-hmm. do gigs. And I sort of didn't really tell anybody I'd gone to Berlin. Because I didn't want people to like...
Stop calling.
Be like, oh, well, yeah, it's great. So I still had a UK phone and stuff.
Cool.
So I did that for about a year. But during that year, a lot of things changed. Like that girl I was with, we broke up.
Yeah. Sorry, my doorbell's just rang. Can you just give me 5 seconds to run to the door and come back?
Yeah. No problem.
Sorry, I'll just edit that out, that ringing noise. Sorry, man, I'll be 10 seconds.
All right, cool.
Right, sorry. So we were talking.
Yeah, I don't know where we were. Right. So during that year where I moved to Berlin, that relationship I was in ended. And so I was sort of free and single in Berlin, and I was like a bit, I didn't know what to do, and sort of, I thought, well, I can do anything I want to do now. And I just sort of thought, well, I've always wanted to go to New York and it was something I couldn't really do before. So I might just try and do that. So I just sort of decided to go to New York. But the point where I made the decision until the point where it became a reality was about a year, because I had to fulfill some work commitments.
Yeah.
But also getting the visa together and stuff was quite a bit of work.
Yeah, I can imagine that's horrible.
Mm. And I didn't want to apply to schools. I just didn't want to go to school, you know. Because firstly it's really expensive. And at that point, it was like 2008, 2009, I'd actually played with a few like really good American musicians in Europe. And I thought that, you know, having those contacts might be kind of useful.
Yeah.
Just go there and sort of connect with them and see what that leads to. You
know? Yeah.
But I just wanted to play, you know. And the great thing about New York is that everyone wants to play all the time.
Yeah.
No matter what level, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's how you know that's how you sort of stay good at it. You have to keep applying your craft, you know.
Yeah.
So that was cool. So yeah.
So who were you playing with then when you were moved there? Or who were the contacts that you were kind of looking to?
Well, people I'd played with in Europe who were from the States. I don't know, people like, well, I played with Bill Stewart and Mark Copeland and Greg Osby and like Ari Honig and Jonathan Kreuzberg and Kurt Rosenwinkel.
Yeah.
Although he was actually living in Berlin then, but
oh, cool.
He was coming to the States a lot anyway.
Yeah.
And then like British people who live there, like John Escreet.
Yeah.
Who is actually an old friend anyway.
Oh,
and
cool.
People, Will Vincent.
Yeah.
Who was there. And, you know, so as soon as you go there, even if you only know 10 people, I mean, then that multiplies like instantly.
Yeah.
So yeah. Just knowing those people, I didn't really see like people like Bill Stewart, you know, he's just sort of very busy and he's never in town, but you know, I would see Mark Copeland and people like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, just led to meeting loads of new people all the time. I mean, you meet so many new people all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, just very quick to make contacts, you know.
That sounds cool. And I bet you were mega happy just playing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. It was a new lease of life, really. And it was really the kick in the arse I needed.
Yeah.
From a musical point of view.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing when you're having been in London and being somewhat kind of respected, I guess.
Yeah.
In London. And basically going to New York where nobody knows nobody knew who I was and nobody gave a shit, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever you think you're good at, I mean, it doesn't matter. And you know, there's always a bunch of people who are better than you.
Yeah.
At every corner, you know. So you gotta take a bit of a gulp of humility, you know.
Yeah.
Which was hard at first because it was like, oh, my ego is sort of getting slammed here.
Yeah, I can imagine.
in a way, it's very liberating.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, I'm just like everyone else. Just gotta work hard. And,
yeah.
You know.
So, and then, yeah, but, yeah, sorry, yeah. Go on.
No, go on.
I was just curious about you, then the driving force between you moving back to Germany, or do you still, are you like permanently living in Berlin now?
Yeah, it's a bit of it's sort of part of a convoluted story, so circumstances. I wasn't planning on moving back. When I had a visa that I lived in the States for,
yeah,
and that runs out every 3 years. So right. I applied for another visa. And you've got to be out of the country when you apply for that.
Yeah.
But there was some bureaucratic complications and I kept getting rejected.
Right.
And I kept having to reapply and it's just a bureaucratic nightmare.
Oh, I can't even begin to imagine how horrible it is to go through all that crap.
Yeah. I was kind of stuck. But the other thing was during that whole time, I'd actually met someone else who's my girlfriend now.
Yeah.
She's actually from Berlin. She's a Berliner.
And, right.
We were sort of long distance the whole time I was in New York. And so while I was in New York, I was still coming back to Europe quite a bit and seeing her and stuff. And so basically in while I was waiting for this second visa to get renewed, I was just living with her.
Yeah.
But that took a year before, when I got that visa actually accepted, a year. And that point, and during that time, I'd been working a lot in Europe, actually.
Yeah.
So I was quite busy because I had this gig with this guy, Dafa Yusuf.
Right.
He's like a oud player and singer. I started playing with him while I was still in New York, but it was actually quite convenient being in Europe because all these gigs are in Europe.
So yeah.
I was busy with that. And then when the visa eventually came, I had a pretty full diary for the next 6-8 months. So I was like, I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to go back
yeah.
to the States. So I just thought I'd get the visa, but like go back to New York like as often as I could, basically. Yeah. That's kind of how I've done it. So I've sort of kept my residence in Berlin.
Oh, nice. Does the visa allow you to then work in New York if you got a gig in it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, you can try it on a tourist visa, but it's a bit risky.
Yeah, of course.
It's really expensive to get the O1 visa, you know.
Yeah.
It's a pain in the ass, to be honest. But.
Yeah, I can. We've just had Will Vinson and John Escrete on. And obviously the O1 visa's like a big part of both shows.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a massive undertaking.
You know? Yeah. So is there any projects that you've done over the years that have really stood out for you in terms of like musical enjoyment?
Hmm. Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, loads. It's hard to just pick one, though.
Yeah, well, you don't have to. I was just curious.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, really. Well, I really learned a lot playing with Daffer, actually.
Yeah.
I played in his band for 4.5 years. And it was the only band I've really been in for that long where you're working a lot and playing with the same people,
yeah,
all the time. And something different happens, I think, when you're working with the same people regularly. In that, the musical connection that you make is on a deeper level.
Yeah,
it's like when you're first playing with people, you're sort of touching base, right, trying to establish what you have in common. And
mm-hmm.
when you're playing with the same people over and over for years, another thing happens where there's a much a deeper connection, you know.
Yeah.
And you can get to sort of deeper places in the music more quickly, you know, and you can take more risks. And sort of, I think sometimes when you're playing with people for the first time and you're taking a lot of risks and taking a lot of liberties, that adds a lot, that, you know, adds the great possibility for confusion.
Yeah.
Things can go wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas when you know people really well, you can take all those risks and people are just like, well, I'm just going to go with you wherever you're going and see where we end up. You know?
Yeah.
That's great to develop that kind of relationship. I had that a bit with Gwilym as well, because we played together a lot
for
quite a few years. But that was such a long time ago. And I don't feel like I was really, you know, quite good enough at that point. Yeah.
Right.
But still, you know, there was something there. I don't know, in New York, I don't know, there's something great about just playing sessions every day.
Yeah.
Just the daily routine of playing. Sometimes it's with people you've never met. Sometimes it's people you know well. You get to that, you find you can get to that place of making a deep connection faster somehow.
I guess maybe lots of practice of, like you say, like every day, different people, different music, and you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you get good at sort of assessing a situation quicker.
Yeah.
Sort of seeing, you know, what's gonna be possible for you to do, you know. And then, because I think what I notice a lot with inexperienced players is it's nothing really to do with what they're capable of playing. It's more just assessing a situation and recovery, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think a lot of young dudes are just really intent on like doing their thing and practicing and playing the thing they've been practicing. They don't have any regard really for assessing the situation they're in right there and who else is there and what. You know, every person in that room brings with them a whole world of experience and issues or lack thereof, you know.
Yeah.
And you've got to kind of suss these things out very quickly, I think.
Yeah.
For it to be good and to make a connection, you know, you got to know what's sort of achievable.
Yeah.
So I guess I got kind of better at that in New York somehow.
Yeah.
It's hard to figure out why, but I think it might be because people are really good. For the first time, I felt like people were really listening to me.
Actually, right.
Somehow. And I felt like I wasn't just like doing an impersonation
yeah.
of a bass player. I felt like I was actually playing myself, playing with my ideas, you know.
Yeah, I took my sax to New York once and I had a couple of lessons while I was there. And that's the thing that kept coming back to haunt me, was people being like you're just not listening enough. Like, like you're not, you know, even if you are, it's still not enough. It's not enough all the time.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, and how much people would, like you say, like they'd so much listening and interacting and not so much ever feeling like someone was playing, like to play what they wanted, or like hosing in licks that they'd learned that day.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's the main difference, actually. Listening is the main difference.
Yeah.
And it's actually, you know, like when I play, I try to listen way more than I think about what I'm actually doing myself.
Yeah.
Just try to make everything I do somehow work with what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more fun to do it that way.
Yeah.
Because you find yourself playing stuff that you didn't even know you could play, or you surprise yourself, you know.
Yeah. I guess that's where it's so much more fun than practicing on your own, or when you put that stuff into action and it's supposed to be incredibly conversational and interactive.
Yeah.
Which you can't replicate on your own.
No.
So if you had to create, this might go horribly wrong, this question, we've often done this with past guests, like a dream band, and you can have anyone you want in the world in it. Do you have any idea, like, who you would have, what you would create?
Dead or alive?
Yeah, anything. It's all on the cards here. We're just going to play some jazz podcast sort of fantasy land.
A dream band?
Yeah.
Do I have to be in the band?
Good question. You could do, like, two basses, like the Top of the Pops thing. That's up to you if you want to be in it or not.
No, wouldn't do a two bass thing. I don't know, to be honest. I guess it's weird coming up with a dream band that you're not part of, because, you know, like, I think the Miles Davis Quintet of 50s and 60s, that's kind of a dream band in itself.
Yeah, all right, fine. You have to be in it. I think that makes...
Yeah, that probably... Yeah, God, I have no idea, man. I mean, there's people I would love to play with, you know, like people I've dreamed of playing with my whole life, but I don't know if that necessarily would sound good to anyone else. I'd love to play with Jack DeJohnette. He's like, my dream drummer to play with, you know.
Yeah.
Well, maybe just Keith Jarrett and Jack DeJohnette.
Man, that would be something.
Or Bill Evans.
He's
pretty much a massive hero of mine.
Yeah.
And Coltrane. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know, I'm not very good at that question.
No.
Sorry.
No, it's fun to play these games. I just thought of another question and then I immediately forgot it. Oh man, what could that be about? It was something to do with this
creative bands.
Yeah. No, it's gone forever. Oh, I got it. You know, you've traveled a lot. You're a perfect man to ask this question to. If you had to vote for somebody in the world to, like, be like the international president of all of jazz.
Yeah.
Who would you vote for?
International president for all of jazz.
Some kind of international representative who would, like, go to the UN, make speeches about why we like it. It's a bit of a bizarre idea.
I don't know. I have to think about that one.
Someone with charisma and leadership skills who can create more funding.
Right. Doesn't have to be a musician, right? Could be anybody.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. We could elect somebody much more practical than a fellow jazz musician.
Someone, their job is basically to provide support for, like, jazz musicians worldwide in some form or other.
Yeah, that's their job. Oh, my God.
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, no matter who gets the job, there'll be certain people around who gets have their feathers ruffled, you know?
Mm. True.
I don't know. No idea. Barack Obama?
Oh, that's perfect. I love it. I'm immediately in love. This is perfect. I'm going to write to him.
He needs a new job now anyway, doesn't he?
He's got nothing to do, and we would all appreciate him, and I'm sure he'd appreciate us.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he's got a penchant for British jazz, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm going to write to him. People love niche podcasts.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Phil, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No worries, man.
It's been a pleasure. Is there anything coming up that we should know about before I let you go forever? Any interesting projects or anything that you're particularly excited?
Well, I'm working on a new record of my own stuff.
Oh, great. A new album.
Yeah.
That'll be your third album.
Yeah, I guess.
Cool.
Well, the first one I did wasn't really a proper album. I didn't really release it.
Right.
I just put it on iTunes like 7 years after I recorded it.
Oh, cool.
But so I guess it's technically this will be the second sort of official album.
Right.
I've written all the material, but it's just trying to sort of get everybody involved in the same place for a week to rehearse and record.
I can imagine.
Proving quite difficult.
Yeah.
And also I have to practice the stuff because I can't really play it yet myself. That's a challenge I'm working up to.
Great. Hopefully, that sounds cool.
Hopefully it works out. It could all go horribly wrong, but you know, you got to take risks sometimes, I think. Other than that, just working around really, a few little things here and there.
Yeah.
I'm teaching as well. I teach in Hanover.
Oh, cool.
Hanover University.
Yeah.
One day a week. It's just little tours, really.
Sounds good, man. Yeah. Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled for this album.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Great. Right.
Thanks, Phil.
All right, man.
Sweet. I'll speak to you at some point in the future, I'm sure.
Man. Thanks for making this happen and success.
My pleasure. I
wish you a lot of success with it.
Oh, thanks.
It's a great thing you're doing, actually. I've enjoyed, I've listened to a few of them now.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Great.
I just wanted to create like a central hub where over the course of the next few years, I can get everyone everyone who's up for it, you know, just so everyone's in like a virtual hang.
It's great. I think a lot of people, it's really helpful for people because I think, you know, some people aren't sure what they're doing and why and stuff like that. And it's just to hear other people's experiences, it just gives a lot of clarity and reassurance.
Yeah, I think
definitely. It's a really good thing. You know, it's a very healthy thing. I listen to another podcast a lot called WTF. It's about comedy.
Oh, cool.
This guy called Mark Maron. He's a great comedian himself, but about 8 years ago, he started doing a podcast basically for other stand-ups.
Right.
Just talk about their life and their story. It's very similar to what you're doing here.
Oh, cool.
And I've just really enjoyed listening to that. It's just really interesting listening to other people's experiences.
Yeah. One of our inspirations was a show called The Magic Podcast, which the co-host Dan listens to. And that's the same deal. Again, just magicians like all just chatting about how they got into it and what they learned.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just shared ideas, shared, you know, dialogues. It's just a great thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for adding to the pot.
No problem.
Beautiful. All right, take care, man.
All right, man. Talk soon.
Speak to you soon. Bye.
So, Dan, last week I went to the Barbican and I have two things to say about it. First of all, at the weekend you can park all day for £9.
Mm.
I know, a London parking bargain. And unbelievably for me, from Sunbury, it's a lot faster than the train. So,
right.
I know.
How much is a train ticket over to there?
Like £16.
Oh, so it's cheaper if you're both going.
It's a lot cheaper to drive. It's a sad world we live in when public transport is a more expensive and slower choice than to just drive and slowly destroy the planet. Although we both own Nissan Micras, the official car of the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, of course. Yep.
So they're not too polluting. Being worse. So anyway, while I was there, went to see Kurt Elig, Branford Marsalis. Quintet gig. It was absolutely ridiculous. I was really, really shocked by just how good it was. I mean, I thought it would be good, otherwise I wouldn't have gone. But my God, if you get a chance to see that gig while it's on tour, go forth, people. It's well worth it. Kurt reminds me a bit of George Clooney in Gravity. He's got this brilliant sort of... He's a bit like a string puppet. Like, his body and his head aren't quite, you know... they don't behave in the normal way when he sings, but it's fantastic.
Right.
Great to watch.
Yeah, I've never seen him. I'd like to see him live.
It was cool, I must admit. It was fun to see him really get stuck in and sing like an improvising instrument, you know. He got his hands dirty, I'll say that much.
How long are they... How many more shows are they doing in the UK?
It's into Europe already, annoyingly. They only did two, one at Wigan Jazz Festival and one at the Barbican.
Right.
So a big coup for Wigan.
Why Wigan?
I don't know. They have a really cool jazz festival, though.
Okay.
When I used to live in Manchester, Wigan was the, you know, the big boy. But now I've said all that, I'm kind of nervous. Like, what if I'm wrong and it just wasn't there? You know, this podcast doesn't come with a great deal of... Oh, no, I've just checked. It's fine. They did play there.
Wikipedia or a podcast, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very questionable knowledge all the time. Ambrose Akinmusir played as well. Sweet. Right, so next week, we're back. We're back every Friday.
Because we're doing every Friday again.
Every single Friday. Yeah, because I've got nothing to do. I'm unbelievably free, it hurts. And I've got so many interviews already. And a lot of them need to be out there because we're talking about things that are coming up and gigs in August and stuff. So we're just going to chuck it all out there. And then come September, you know, because the Jazz Podcast salary is so small, I'm going to...
There's a salary? I didn't even know there was one. Have you been paying yourself, Rob?
Out of our money, yes.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I'll have to go back to school in September and then we can take a little break. Great. A well-earned break. So anyway, next week is Rachel Cohen.
Who's Rachel Cohen?
She is an alto player. She was born in the Shetland Islands. So Yes, a lovely Scottish accent. And then she studied in Birmingham, so she's kind of knows a lot about that scene, but she lives in London now. She's on Mike Janish's label, Whirlwind. So that will be cool. And then also in the pipeline for the Summer of the Jazz podcast, let me think about this, George Crowley, Chris Montague, Brigitte Baraha, Liam Noble, and John Halliwell from Supertramp. That's the bare minimum quality of guest. So, a big coup for us on the road to getting Charlie Watts is John Halliwell.
Okay, is he the first step? The second step, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. John's going to prove that I can go to somebody's house and behave in a dignified manner.
Oh, man, you should have seen Rob at some of the houses we've been to.
Exactly, my reputation's been somewhat affected. Yeah. So it's time to pick it up again. Sweet.
Wow.
Well, here
Got
we are.
Much on this week, or are you?
No. I'm just going to leaf through my diary. Maybe talk to George tomorrow. I'm going to play jazz football on Sunday. If anyone
What's
wants
jazz
to play
football?
It's just football with jazz musicians. There's no like special rules because you know, because of the Muso thing. So if anyone wants to come play football in Brixton on a Sunday, please get in touch. Because we, you know, we always need more players.
Who plays?
Dave Hamlet, me.
Just the two of you?
Yeah, 1v1. That's why I need more players. who else normally plays? Alex Monk. He's a fantastic football player.
is it?
Yeah, Tom Taylor, Ben Lloyd Evans, and Will Green from the band 1000 Things. Not really the jazz scene, but...
Is that what they're calling themselves
these days? Big-time music scene. Yeah, that was formerly Feldspar.
Formerly before that was something else, wasn't it?
I don't think so. Oh, no, maybe there was something in between. Mm. Not sure about that, but if you want to listen to
change their name every other year.
They're like a phoenix of the music scene. Lots of rebirth. But
yeah.
If you want to listen to some nice sort of music that's not jazz, go and Google 1000 Things and you can have a nice time. In the meantime...
Colouring in. Sounds like you're colouring in.
No, sorry, I was just fidgeting.
Okay.
I've got a repair guy here, so he's just, you know, getting some shit done.
Does he want a feature on the podcast?
I might go and ask him if he wants to do a segment about how I broke my doors.
I think we'll save that for another time.
Yeah. Oh, and George Crowley's coming to football, but he's so bad he's refusing to play. He says that his skills are so poor he will undermine beyond repair any team that he's on.
Is he going to cheerlead?
Yeah, big time. He's just going to stand on the sidelines. I might make him record.
Bring his horn.
Oh, yeah, that's the stuff. I want him to play St. Thomas on a loop for 2 hours. That'd be amazing.
That would be great.
That is something. I love the jazz podcast. All right, it's over. See you next week, Dan.
Yep, have a good one.
Take it easy. And
ciao.
Ciao indeed. We will see you all next Friday.